Our next speaker is Tay Evans from MassDMF, who's going to talk to us about conservation moorings as potential eelgrass habitat protection and cooperative habitat protection partnerships.
Can everyone hear me? Okay. My name is Jay Evans, and I work at the Massachusetts Division of Marine Fisheries. And I'm going to talk about, like Phil said, I'm going to talk about the use of conservation moorings, which is an innovative design, new design for moorings, to protect eelgrass habitat. And this is a project that's under a NOAA initiative, which is the Cooperative Habitat Protection Partnership. So, four parts to the talk. First, I'm going to discuss the impact of moorings on seagrass. Then I'll talk about the traditional moorings that most of us are familiar with versus these conservation mooring systems. I'll go into the Cooperative Habitat Protection Partnership a little bit. It's called CHIPS. And then discuss our preliminary ideas for this demonstration project. So, impacts of traditional moorings on eelgrass habitat. Well, most of us are familiar with the traditional mooring, which it has a heavy mushroomer weight attached to a heavy chain, attached to a buoy with a pennant. And the heavy chain is designed to drag on the bottom. It's part of the design, so it's laying there on the bottom, and as the current and the tide changes, it'll drag around and create a scar. So if this is an eelgrass bed, this chain's moving, you know, it's ripping up everything that is rooted there. So those are the direct impacts, both the weight and the chain dragging. The indirect impact is going to be the turbidity that it's kicking up, and that is going to reduce light, could reduce light and affect eelgrass not only in that path, but also maybe adjacent eelgrass. All right, so here's the Bahamas, and I love Maine. I went to college in Maine. I love being back here. I love the snow, but it's also sometimes nice to look at a nice tropical picture. And so the other thing that's nice about adding this picture, aside from the palm trees, is that the water's so clear in the Bahamas. And unlike Fred, I don't get to go to exotic places to study seagrass, so I have to do it on my vacation time. And this was a picture I took on vacation, and I was kind of shocked by how obvious the mooring scars are. I mean, you can just see, you can see these you know, blown out areas where there's no seagrass living there at all. So this is the same harbor, an aerial photograph of the same harbor. There aren't too many boats there, but where there are boats, there are these huge mooring scars, and it's really obvious here. Closer to home, this is Manchester Harbor, Manchester, Mass., and I roughly overlaid the DEP 2001 eelgrass layer. So this is an eelgrass bed here, and you can see the pockmarks from the mooring field. There's definitely mooring having an impact here too. So, if you had any hesitation about the cumulative impact of moorings, I think that this picture probably might change your mind. Obviously, Massachusetts has a really developed coastline, and everyone seems to be wanting to get boats, and there's a high demand for moorings, so by necessity, harbor masters are packing moorings into harbors, and so you get, this is Marblehead Harbor, in the summer it's just packed with moorings. And here, I just kind of roughly sketched the DEP 2001 eelgrass layer. There's eelgrass growing along the edge of Marblehead Harbor, so it's right here. There's no eelgrass growing in the middle. I don't know why, but I can imagine it's probably tough for it to infiltrate into this harbor. So mooring impacts have been studied extensively, and I just wanted to highlight a few studies that addressed impacts to seagrass. A couple in Western Australia, Walker looked at the scars that mooring produced and measured 3 to 300 meters squared for the scars. And this was in Posidonia and Amphibolus monospecific beds. She also found that the moorings were increasing the edge, and this was making the situation more vulnerable to erosion and more vulnerable to blowouts. So you can get further exacerbated. Also, interestingly, not as much for us with eelgrass, but because it's multi-species habitat, she found that the plants that were growing back in were more pioneer species, so it was having a change in species composition because of the mooring effect. Again, in Western Australia, Hastings found that the edge had doubled from 1941 to 1992 because of moorings. And the differences in impacts were related to the site's exposure and the sediment characteristics at the site. And then here, Monte Falcone did a backy design and called for the adoption of seagrass-friendly moorings. So what are seagrass-friendly moorings? Well, this is the traditional mooring that we discussed, and here's the impact and the large scour area. And the idea of a conservation mooring is just the design is that there's a flexible road. So it doesn't need to drag on the ground. It's kind of like a rubber band. There are a couple different designs, but the idea is that it keeps it off the ground, thereby allowing animals and plants to grow right up into the area under the mooring. These are a couple different designs. This one has a helical anchor, so there it minimizes the direct impact to the bottom. And then this has a poly rope. Here, there's a weight, so there is a small impact on the bottom, but this flexible road, it really is like a rubber band. It's just this black rubber thing. And they tested it. They did all kinds of extensive tests to look at how it withstands hurricanes, and they do. They pulled it. They had like two tugboats pulling against each other, and it didn't break. So they're really strong, but they still move up and down with the tide. This is what it looks like. There's a helical anchor in here, and then it's a flexible road, and so you can see that the impact is minimized. Conservation moorings, I don't know how many of you out there have heard of them or if they're being used, but they are being used in Massachusetts. They're being used right now proactively, so some private people are deciding to change their moorings to conservation moorings. It's up front, it's a high cost, but I've been told the maintenance is less, so in the long run it may be a better investment for people. Also, municipalities are starting to go this way proactively. It's also being suggested as a permit condition when resource agencies review projects like a marina that wants to relicense its moorings, will recommend that they use conservation moorings. Also, not just in eelgrass, but also adjacent to eelgrass. And then another thing that's being discussed right now, still kind of a question, is can we suggest the use of conservation moorings as mitigation alternatives? So to mitigate for or offset for impacts from other projects to eelgrass. There's a lot of questions here, and in order to go forward and continue recommending them, we really need to know some quantitative information about this. So this seemed like a good topic to look at under the Cooperative Habitat Protection Partnership. Like I said before, this is a NOAA initiative, and the idea is to emphasize habitat protection before you have to do the habitat restoration. So get at projects that can address habitat protection. Another big component is establishing the federal, state, local, and NGO partnerships to support this kind of habitat protection and promote awareness and stewardship of fish habitats and to provide technical assistance and small grants. There's a big outreach component to this project. There are a bunch of other CHIPS projects around the country. And they range from, in Texas, there's a project looking at supporting living shorelines to protect fish habitat, to in Alaska, they're doing stream assessment for watershed planning. And now we have this project in the vineyard promoting the use of conservation moorings and also doing their assessment for their effectiveness. So So far, CHIPS Massachusetts, we've developed our federal, state, and local partnership with NIPS, with EPA, with MassCZM, MassDMF, and the Nature Conservancy. And we've secured funding, and we've developed our interpretational display that we're going to put out at a boat ramp that kind of describes the importance of eelgrass and what we're doing. We've purchased some moorings, some of these conservation moorings, and we're going to put them in Vineyard Haven, and that'll be part of our demonstration project. We are looking for additional sites, and we're still working on the monitoring plan. I'll talk to you a little bit about that. So this is Vineyard Haven. For those of you familiar, this is Vineyard Haven Harbor. The ferry comes in here. Underneath the bridge here is Lagoon Pond. And this picture right here is from this mooring field right here. But I put it in because this is actually a conservation mooring. So there's some conservation moorings that are proactively already in the mooring field out here. One of the reasons why we picked this site, one of the biggest reasons, was because the local harbor master and shellfish warden was really enthusiastic, really wanted to figure out a way to be supported, and figure out a way to get these conservation moorings into the harbor, and specifically Lagoon Pond, right in here. This picture was taken from a shallow water, extensive eelgrass bed right here in Lagoon Pond, and it's just filled with bay scallops. You look over the boat entry, you just see bay scallops everywhere. It's really cool, and I think this is probably one of the motivators for the shellfish warden to, you know, to try to protect this resource because it is harvested. Interestingly, the harvesting doesn't seem to impact the eelgrass, but there's a mooring field right here, and there's a clear edge. So the mooring field's kicking up sediment and not enabling the eelgrass to grow where it needs to grow, right next to the productive eelgrass bed. So we thought this would be a good site if we could locate some of the traditional moorings that are in this eelgrass bed right here and change them over to conservation moorings and see if it can grow back. Some of our study questions. Will eelgrass grow back in the mooring scar once the mooring is replaced with a conservation mooring, and how long will it take? What will happen to the density, the percent cover, the canopy height in and near the scar? And what impacts will a conservation mooring have on eelgrass if we put it in an unimpacted bed? So what are the impacts of a conservation mooring? And hopefully these study questions will help us address the management questions, which are, can conservation moorings protect eelgrass? Should we continue to recommend conservation moorings as a permit condition? And should we consider conservation moorings for mitigating loss of eelgrass habitat? So, let's see. We have the situation. This is my little diagram of the eelgrass bed and the traditional mooring, the chain dragging here, and the scar. We have this situation in Vineyard Haven in Lagoon Pond, and we're going to convert some of these sites over to, we're going to put a conservation mooring into the scar. And the idea is then to measure how long it takes to go back into the scar. Ideally, we would also have a site where we remove the traditional mooring and we leave it with no mooring and see how long that takes to grow back compared to putting in a conservation mooring. It would also be great to put a conservation mooring in an unimpacted eelgrass and compare that to a natural reference site. We don't have that option at the moment. We're really just limited to these two situations. But this could be something that we develop further in the future. So we'll use some kind of a before-after design with annual monitoring. And I'm thinking we could put a 50-meter transect out, measure the diameter of the scar, collect density percent cover, canopy height within the scar in quadrats, meter square quadrats, as well as the edge of the scar, and then along a gradient, along the transect out from the scar. So my expected results would be that we would see a decrease in the diameter of the scar, An increase in eelgrass density, percent cover within or near the scar. Results may depend on the characteristics of the mooring field, so how many of the moorings were changed over to conservation moorings, how many traditional moorings are left that could be still kicking up turbidity, and also what's the sediment type, what are the waves and current energy in the tidal regime, because that could also impact the results. So there's still a lot to think about. This is a work in progress. I'd love people's ideas and feedback. We're wondering, one of the things we're wondering is how can we incorporate other sites aside from the demonstration project that's associated with the CHIPS initiative? Can we require monitoring as a permit condition when projects are permitted? And can we use that monitoring in analyses altogether? So therefore, are these methods simple enough? Oh, I skipped one. Oh yeah, does anyone know of a candidate site too? Because we are looking for more sites that may have, you know, really good eelgrass beds with defined scars that are clear, that you can replace with a conservation mooring and see the clear, if it is growing back. But are these methods simple enough that they can be required in standard monitoring by many different people, conducted by different people? And will this basic information from, before the removal of a traditional mooring to after, will that be enough quantitative information for us to move forward with our recommendations? Okay, if you are interested in conservation moorings, if you're interested in the CHIPS project, these are a couple of good contacts. Kathy Rodriguez and Chris Bulkey at NOAA are good contacts about the CHIPS program. And conservation moorings, you can find this online. There are a bunch of different companies. Hazlett Marine has a lot of good information on their website, and Seaflex as well. And like I said, there are many different designs out there. So thank you all for your attention. And I'd also like to thank the other people that have been working hard on this project. Phil Colarusso, Chris Bulkey, who's not here, and Tony Wilberg, who's not here. But thank you all.